are gathering far to the north, showing the signs of grim storms to come. Low on the horizon, the six friends had glimpsed the fiery starburst of a hunk of pre-nuke hardware, finally finding its way home through the polluted upper levels of Earth's atmosphere. It was close to 6 months since the friends had last stood on the high plateau, which had been scraped from the side of the hill by an earthslide. The redoubt behind them had been one of those built in the late 1990s in isolated and secret places. The leader of the group, a rangy man in his mid-30s, stood on the edge of the drop, staring down at the ropes of dark blue plated plaslon that had enabled them to make the dangerous climb. The redoubt had been untouched since the day the world caught fire in January 2001, protected by its inaccessibility. When they'd first reached the place, it had looked as though they might never get off the mountain. But they'd made it and traveled to Virginia, and done there what they'd set out to do. Now, after some bizarre adventures, they'd returned to the redoubt. The leader pointed out markings in the dirt.
Looks like someone's been up here, JB. I see footprints hereabouts.
Wouldn't have gotten inside unless they knew the entry code.
The leader was speaking to J.B. Dix, the armorer of the group, a short, terse man who wore a battered fedora hat and wire-rimmed glasses. The brown shirt and gray pants were stained and worn, as were the high combat boots. There was a mini-Uzi slung across his shoulders on a webbing strap and a Steyr-AUG 5.6mm pistol on his right hip. The third member of the group, a tall woman with startlingly green eyes and even more startling red hair, turned from surveying the doors.
Doors seem shut tight, Ryan.
She was only an inch short of 6 feet, with a leanly beautiful body. She wore khaki overalls, torn across the shoulder, and stained with what could have been dried blood. Her boots were dark blue leather, with stacked western heels. They were ornamented with silver spread-wing falcons, and the toes were chiseled points of silver metal. Her name was Christy Roth, and she was in her mid-20s. Christy was the part-mutie lover of the group's unchallenged leader, Ryan Cotter. Wearing the same type of clothes as J.B. Dix, Cotter stood a couple of inches over 6 feet, weighing a muscular 200 pounds. He had a mass of dark curling hair that coiled to his nape. The most striking feature of the harsh face was the black eye patch that covered the left socket. The right side of his face was disfigured by a jagged scar that sliced from the corner of his eye to below the angle of his mouth. The wind tugged at the long, fur-trimmed gray coat that he wore over his pants and shirt. On his left hip was an 18-inch-long steel panga, which was balanced on the right side by a hand blaster, a 9mm Sig Sauer P226 pistol, 25.5 ounces of efficient chilling machine. Ryan gripped a Heckler & Koch G12 automatic rifle in his right hand and carried a couple of spare 50-shot mags in his coat pockets.
We better take care when we get inside. Could be trouble. And before we get to the gateway in the Matren's chamber, we'll stock up on bullets, get some self-eats and ring poles of food and water. Fresh backpacks. They'll come in handy.
14-year-old Jack Lauren screwed up his face in disgust.
Don't like self-heats. Tastes like warm mud. Not so good.
Jack had joined the group less than a year ago when they were involved in bloody fighting down in Louisiana. Fully clothed and soaking wet, he weighed in at just over 100 pounds, but he was the most lethally destructive hand-to-hand fighter Ryan Cotter had ever seen. And he'd seen plenty. Jack was dressed in denim jeans with a jacket made out of leather and canvas, hand-colored gray, green, and brown to camouflage it. Under it, he wore a ragged fur vest with the sleeves hacked out. A massive .357 Magnum pistol with a 6-inch barrel stuck out of a crude leather holster on his hip. Concealed on his person were several slim, leaf-bladed throwing knives. But your first impression of Jack Lauren was not based on his dress or weaponry. The first thing you noticed was the mane of pure white hair that floated across the whipcord shoulders. Then you saw the eyes, glowing deep in the sockets of wind-scoured ivory like angry rubies. The contrast with his colorless skin was startling. Jack also carried facial scars. One disfigured his narrow nose, and another gouged jaggedly over the left cheek, tugging the corner of the mouth up in a crooked, mocking, perpetual smile. The other two members of the party were huddled in the lee of the overhanging rock shelf by the doors into the complex. One was a tall, staggeringly beautiful blonde girl wearing a short crimson skirt and blouse under a gray fur coat. Her name was Lori Quint. The man with his arm around her, against the rising wind, was her lover, teacher, and protector. He was older, Measure it one way, and he was around 230. Put another way, he might only be somewhere around 32 years old. He looked to be in his mid-60s. In fact, Dr. Theophilus Algernon Tanner had been born in South Stratford, Vermont, on February 14, 1868. On June 17, 1891, he'd married Emily Louise Chandler. They'd had two children, Rachel and Julian. In November of 1896, Doc Tanner had disappeared. The scientists on Project Cerberus, operating from a redoubt in Virginia, had been carrying out experiments in time travel, a process known in the arcane trade as trawling. They tried several times, including picking up a New York State Supreme Court judge. But what arrived in the Crontrans chamber generally resembled several pounds of chopped liver. The scientists' single success was Doc Tanner, who arrived with them, more or less in one piece, in 1998. Having been untimely ripped from his own home and life, Doc proved exceedingly uncooperative with the gray-faced men in white lab coats. Though they tried to involve him in their work, he kept insisting on being returned to his family. In fact, he made several illegal attempts to operate the Crontrans himself. In the end, he became a guinea pig for a second time. This time, the transmission took place in December 2000, only a matter of days before the Holocaust that destroyed civilization throughout the planet. Doc was plunged forward into a dreadful world, nearly 100 years on, to a frontier dirtville called Moxon, up near the Darks. His mind scrambled, he was taken prisoner by the local Baron, Jordan Teague, and became the particular toy of the Baron's sect chief, the sadistic Cord Strasser. Eventually, after the bloody shambles of a big firefight, the old man was rescued by Ryan Cotter. Doc's memory was still erratic, but he was generally becoming more coherent. Ryan glanced back at him. In some odd way, Doc seemed to be getting younger. Ryan attributed this to the influence of Lori Quint. Tanner was the tallest of the party, topping Ryan by an inch or so, and was skinny built, wearing a stained and faded frock coat over a blue denim shirt. His shrunk shanks slotted into cracked knee boots. Doc's face was deeply lined, his eyes a pale blue, and a fringe of long gray hair framed his skull. Despite his age, Doc's teeth were peculiarly excellent. For some time after they first met, Ryan never saw Doc Tanner without a battered stovepipe hat that looked like it could have once belonged to Abe Lincoln. But when they were sailing down the Hudson, heading south from the redoubt toward Virginia, Doc had lost patience with the hat and wheeled it into the foaming water. Doc's contribution to the armament of the group was twofold. He carried an elegant ebony walking stick with a silver lion's head as its handle. A twist and a pull revealed the steel rapier blade concealed inside the cane. And on his hip, in a hand-tooled Mexican rig, was a gun about as old as Doc himself. It was a double-barreled Lamah blaster, which fired 36-caliber ammunition. A quick adjustment of the firing pin, and it blasted out a single round of 63-caliber scattergun ammunition. Doc wasn't much of a marksman, but using the shotgun barrel of the Lamah at close range meant you didn't need to be that accurate. They were six friends, moving through the scorched lands like a cleansing wind, generally leaving things a little better than they found them.
352 code, Doc.
I beg your pardon, my dear Ryan. What was that you said?
Let Lori be for a minute and pay attention. Entrance code into the redoubt?
Certainly. Now, let me see. I would imagine that it is 3 and 5 and 2, Ryan, is it not?
Sounds good. Let's try it.
The wind was rising, and the chem clouds gathering to spring. Already they could make out jagged silver slashes of lightning spearing the tops of the mountains to the north. Ryan had seen storms so severe that they could kill an unprotected man, and Trader had often mentioned seeing freak weather down south that carried acid rain from hot spots, powerful enough to take the skin off a person in a couple of minutes, and leave him dead in 5. Ryan punched in the numbered code on the elevated panel, waiting for the familiar hiss of hydraulics as the powerful sectors began to operate. The darkness within suddenly blossomed with light as the sensors picked up movement of the doors. As soon as the gap was wide enough, Jack darted through, blaster in hand, calling for the others to follow him as soon as he was sure the main entrance region was safe and clear. Ryan came through last, feeling the sting of hail on his cheeks as the storm came shrieking in after them. the reverse code of 253, sent the doors sliding shut once more. Inside the redoubt was the familiar feeling of dead stale air and a heavy silence all around them.
Nobody here.
Maybe, lover.
You hear something, Christy?
I can't tell, JB. Someone's been here recently, within the last week or so, but the doors...
Ryan had already checked. From the prints in the dust, he could clearly make out that nobody had been in or out that way since they passed through the doors months ago.
Maybe someone saw when we come out and then stopped poking around? Thought we came from inside so they could get in, maybe.
Better get stocked up on ammo, then go to the dorms and sleep. Rest up. We'll go to the Metrans gateway in the morning after we eat. How's that sound to everyone else?
Looking around, Ryan realized how bone-weary they all looked. It had been hard times trying to return to this redoubt, far harder than he'd imagined when they left Virginia. Maybe it would be better if they took a few days in the safety of the redoubt to recharge their personal batteries.
Beds first.
I believe that I might second that particular motion, Ryan. It's been too long since I laid these weary old bones on anything softer than granite.
Sure thing, Doc. Straight to the dorms. Eat, sleep. We'll see how the morning looks.
The plan of the complex, just inside the main entrance, showed that the redoubt had only the single way in and out. But if Christie's muti senses were to be believed, and someone had gotten in, then the earth slides over the years could have exposed some distant part of the building. It was cold inside, despite the warmth of the summer weather outside. It seemed to Ryan that more of the lights in the angles of walls and ceilings had malfunctioned. It crossed his mind, but he set the thought aside, that the gateway itself might also have stopped working. They went along in a careful single file, Jack in the lead, followed by Ryan. Then came Christy, followed by Doc and Lori. As usual, JB brought up the rear of the group. At each interior door, or at the turning of a passage, everyone stopped, flattened against the curving walls, waiting until Jack had checked it out. One of the trader's sayings that Ryan remembered was about caution. Nobody's ever gotten himself chilled from being careful. Even so, the ambush was so skillfully laid that it nearly took them. The muties must have had phenomenal hearing, sharp enough to catch the whispering sounds of Ryan and the others as they catfooted their way along the corridors, giving them time to lay their plan and take up their hiding places. They'd picked the spot well. It was an open area that had probably been used by the guards of the redoubt for eating. There were several dozen plass-topped tables stacked along one wall, and a metal serving counter ran down the center, with deep recesses spaced along its length, which would have held the dishes of food. The corridor opposite led directly to the sleeping quarters, then to the storage sections of the redoubt, and finally to the Matran's gateway. Jack Lauren turned to call to Ryan. If the muties had been armed with blasters, they could easily have chilled all six.
Fire blast!
The tables went skittering over as four came bursting out from cover, and a half dozen leapt from the shadowy hollows of the serving counter. All were holding knives and spears. In that microsecond of shock, Ryan's fighting brain was working in overdrive, appraising the situation, calculating odds and angles. 10 against 6, lances against blasters, surprise on their side. None of the muties was taller than 5.5 feet. They were men, with the tops of their skulls shaved clean and a shaggy fringe of hair dangling at the sides and back. All wore home-weave jerkins and pants, and sandals made from old landwag tires. The attack was so unexpected that the muties got close to their targets without a single shot being fired. The ones from behind the tables concentrated on Doc and Lori, rushing them. JB whirled, facing two more, while Christy and Ryan spun to defend themselves against the last three. Jack, in the lead, was far enough ahead of the rest to be spared the initial attack. It couldn't properly be called a firefight, as the combat was too close for blasters to play much of a part. Only the armorer managed to snap off any bullets, squeezing the trigger on the Uzi, hearing its lethal chatter as it ripped open the bellies and chests of the two muties that had chosen him for their prey. Both went tumbling over in a welter of blood and flailing arms and legs. The other five of JB's companions were too tangled with their enemies for him to risk using the blaster again. A knife flashed, opening Lori's blouse and leaving a thin crimson line of blood seeping over the ribs. Doc had a moment to twist the lion's head of his ebony cane, dropping the cover and lashing out with the hissing steel. The rapier wasn't really suited to the rough and tumble of close combat, but the old-timer succeeded in pinking one of the muties neatly through the throat.
Quiet, you!
He withdrew the blade and lunged again, this time beneath the upraised right arm. The point pierced through the mutie's heart. Christy kicked out at the first of her attackers, slowing down his charge, giving her a splinter of frozen time to draw the 9mm Heckler & Koch from its holster. But the mutie cocked his arm and threw his spear at her, knocking the blaster from her hand.